Well, I want to begin this morning with a question that you probably would not anticipate hearing at church. How's your eyesight? I mean your vision. How is it? Pretty good? No, some of you are shaking your heads, I know. If I'm just really, really honest with you this morning, I'm quickly approaching that place in my life where I'm just going to have to come to terms with reality. In part, it's just kind of vocational hazard. I tend to spend a lot of time reading. I spend a lot of time looking at a computer screen, so that inevitably is going to impact my eyes. I'm going to need at least reading glasses, probably sooner than later. The truth is, I'm still really in denial about it, and I'm not ready to leave denial yet. But I also know that remaining in denial carries with it some risks, because the longer you're in the denial, the more likely it is you're going to run into the sort of situation that will clearly demonstrate to you the discrepancy between your perceptions and reality. You'll learn the hard way that the way you see it is not always the way that it is, and these situations can sometimes be humorous. They can sometimes be dangerous. I don't want to be the guy that one day thinks he's walking into a men's room and in that moment is confronted with the reality that I really need to get glasses. That's not the moment you want to discover that discrepancy between perceptions and reality. This is such a critical thing in our life that our perceptions line up to reality as much as possible. Because not all the stories are humorous like that. You might imagine a young man, he's met a beautiful young woman. He perceives that she feels the way that he feels. He thinks he sees the spark in her eye that he has in his own. So one day he gets down on one knee and he offers her a ring. This is not the moment you want to discover a great deal of discrepancy between the way you saw it and the way it really is. You go for a drive one day because you think the roads are just fine. They don't look that slick. Not the moment you want to discover that your perceptions and realities were not in alignment. These things really, really matter. That's what we see in the story we're going to look at today, beginning in Judges chapter 17. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ear, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord, to Yahweh, from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you." So when he restored the money to his mother took the 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household gods, and he ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That last verse is the explanation for all that comes before it in this passage. It's a time in Israel where everybody is living by their own perceptions, assuming that they're correct. But what the story really serves to do is highlight the utter inadequacy of the singular perspective without any external reference. No other point of reference to know whether your perspective is right or wrong. That's why in the story, in the passage, five verses, they've already broken half the Ten Commandments. gods. But that's what happens when you live by your own perspective. That's our problem too, isn't it? Everybody thinks their vision's pretty good until you have an eye exam, until you're confronted by a Snelling chart. You know the chart. It's the one in the doctor's office where you stand on the line, you cover one eye, and it begins with a really big letter at the top. And if you can't see that one, you've really got problems. And you go on down, and the letters get progressively smaller, and all of a sudden, you're confronted by an objective measurement of how good your vision really is. But we all think it's good until we come to that moment. This is one of those stories that it's so absurd. I mean, it's almost humorous. It's that ridiculous. The story begins with a wealthy mother who has been stolen from, and she has cursed the thief. And she repeats to her son the curse that she's uttered. And I suspect the son, probably nervous that the curse will come down on his head, decides to fess up. He says, hey, Mom, you know that money that went missing that you were cursing about? I took it. Here's what's ridiculous. His mother's response. Immediately, before he even gives the money back, his mom says, oh, blessed is my son in the name of the Lord. I bless you in the name of your... What? First off, I don't think Yahweh blesses this sort of behavior. Your son just stole a very large sum of money from you, and when you find out about it, the first thing you do is bless him in the name of the Lord. I don't think that's how it works. Second, that's not what she should have said, not in my opinion. If I'm his mother, I'm saying, you're moving out of my basement and getting a job. She blesses him. If that's not ridiculous enough, verse 3 is even worse. So the son gives the money that he stole back to his mom, and his mom says, I dedicate this 1,100 pieces of silver to Yahweh to make an idol. Are we talking about the same Yahweh? I don't know if you know who he is. Because he doesn't bless that sort of behavior, and he's pretty clear in what he thinks about idols. Are we talking about the same God here? Now, note to self, bad theology. And by theology, we simply mean what we believe to be true, what we understand about the nature and the person of God, right? So we all have a theology. It's like the word diet. We all have one. We don't use it in that specialized term. If somebody says, I'm going on a diet, what they really mean to say was, well, I had a diet, it just wasn't a very good one, and I'm trying to improve. Theology is the same way. Y'all got one. It's just either good or it's bad. Bad theology is very, very easy to pass from generation to generation. If you look at Micah and you're saying, what is your problem, dude? Why do you have all these terrible ideas about Yahweh? Look at Mom. Look at Mom. So, Mom takes the money back. She dedicates it to Yahweh, all 1,100 pieces of silver. And if you're saying, wait a minute, this sounds a little familiar, you would be right. If you've been reading through the book of Judges, that number, you heard it somewhere. It was in the last story right before this one. 1,100 pieces of silver is how much Delilah betrayed Samson to the Philistines for. Now, there's really nothing in the text that suggests that Micah's mother is the Delilah from the last story. The text doesn't really suggest that. It doesn't preclude it either, but you kind of get the sense that this number's guilty by association. 1,100 pieces of silver is just a bad amount of money. So she dedicates it to Yahweh for the making of an idol. 200 pieces go to the silversmith, and he uses that to fashion the idol. We don't really know where the other 900 go. It's strange that she dedicates all of it, but it's not all used. And then she gives it back to him. good job, Mom. Way to reinforce bad behavior. Your son steals from you, you bless him, make an idol, and then give it all back to him. If you're looking for things you shouldn't do as a parent, here's the laundry list, right? Don't do these things. And so he takes this idol and he sets up a shrine in his house and he has his idol to Yahweh. But that's not all. He gets other stuff. He makes for himself an ephod. Now remember, the ephod is this religious vestment or artifact that you would use to inquire of the Lord. It's how you brought questions to God. But as we've seen in the book of Judges and most of the history of Israel, it's never really used properly. It's always misused. And so he has an ephod, because why not? Gideon had one, he should have one. And then he makes teraphim. He makes some household gods. You can think of, you know, little statuettes, little gods that really serve as like just good luck charms. They'll bring blessing to your house, ward off evil spirits, that sort of stuff. So he has his idol of Yahweh and his ephod and his teraphim and his nice little house shrine, his privatized religion. It's wonderful. And now he needs a priest, but he doesn't have one, so he just grabs one of his sons, says, "Hey, kid, you're the priest." And now he's set up, isn't he? Do you know what the worst part about this story is? It's that he actually thinks he's in the right. He thinks this is a good thing to do. If you were to ask him, he would say, "Sure, I am a good person. More than a good person, I'm a religious person, a very religious person. I don't just go down and worship at the local temple or shrine. Like, I've got my own." Because he was doing what he thought was right in his own eyes. You have to understand that strength of conviction is not a guarantee of the accuracy of perception. You may feel very, very strongly about something. You may be absolutely convinced in your heart, and you still might be wrong. That's the problem when you're only living by what you see without any other point of reference outside of yourself. You'll think you're right, and you'll be absolutely wrong. And that is as much a challenge for us today as it was for them back then. How many of you, by a show of hands, I'm actually really curious, how many of you read the Babylon Bee? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, about, yes, Rodney's like celebrating in the back. Like, he's like, "This is my favorite sermon. Preach it." If you don't know about the Babylon Bee, you really need to. It's on the internet. Just look up Babylon Bee. You'll find it. It's Christian satire. So if you don't know what satire is, go find out about that first, or else you're going to be really, really confused and probably offended. It's satire. But here would be like my bit of spiritual advice for you today. I don't know where you guys get your news. I mean, I got a guess, but I don't really know where all of you get your news. But just quit. Probably the best thing you can do this week. Quit reading the news. Quit watching it. Just read Babylon Bee. That's all you need. I'm just telling you, it's all you need. I came across one of their articles this week that it just dovetailed with what I was preaching so well, I knew I had to read it for you guys. The title of the article is, "Look at these dumb Israelites who keep going back to their idols." According to the sources close to a local man, Christopher Benson, the Christian read his Bible this morning and scoffed at how dumb the Israelites were for continually returning to their idols before he went off to worship his modern-day idols throughout the day. "These Israelites were dumb for worshiping something other than God," scoffed the man, who wastes hours of his life on social media every day, obsesses over his favorite college football team, and spends way too much money on material things in an attempt to keep himself content and satisfied. "I'm like screaming at him the whole time I'm reading, 'Hey dummies, don't you remember how God just saved you from Egypt? Come on, man.' It's almost like there's some lesson in there for modern believers, but I haven't figured out what it is yet. I mean, it's just the Old Testament, so there's probably nothing applicable there." Benson pointed out that God intervened miraculously in the Israelite story time and time again, and yet they kept turning their backs on him. It's like, if I were them, I'd definitely worship Yahweh alone and not turn to all these other false gods. He said, shaking his head, closing his Bible, before going about the rest of his day as if there were no God. We better be careful how quick we pass judgment on Micah, because it's so easy for us to do the exact same thing. To think we see so clearly how things really are. So the rest of chapter 17 is really more of the same. Micah meets a wandering Levite, and it's interesting because Micah seems to understand that the Levites are supposed to be the priests, and so this Levite's just kind of passing through town, and he says, hey, why don't you come be my priest? I'll give you some money. And he does, because what he perceives here is an opportunity to kind of upgrade the shrine, right? But as he does this, he kind of gives us insight into what his problem really is, what it is he actually has. What Micah has is hollowed out religion, right? He's got the right forms. He just doesn't have any of the content. So Micah has the name of the Lord on his lips, but it's clear he does not have his law or his covenant in his heart. Now he has one of Yahweh's priests as his priest, but the priest never takes him back to covenant or right worship of Yahweh. It's all form. It's no content. And honestly, it's a sad story, because Micah says to this young Levite, he says, come, be to me a father and a priest. And then later in the story, it says that this young Levite became to him like one of his own sons. And they have this really strange father-son relationship going on. But what you wonder about is what isn't said. Well, what happened to your first son, who wasn't like a son to you? He was your son, you know, the one you made a priest. What happens to him? We don't know. The story doesn't tell us. He just seemingly is replaced. But then you get verse 13, and this really gets to the heart of it. He says, now I know for sure that Yahweh will prosper me because I have a Levite as my priest. And what he betrays here is the fundamental problem of idolatry. It's the fundamental problem of all perverted worship. Idolatry, perverted worship, it always bends back in on itself. That is to say, in the final analysis, idolatry is never really about the worship of just false gods or idols. Ultimately, it's about the worship of self. You see, for Micah, Yahweh is not the end. Yahweh's not the one to whom he's trying to get. That relationship, covenant relationship with Yahweh, is not what is all-consuming. No, Yahweh has become a means to an end. The ultimate importance for Micah is his own prosperity. Yahweh will prosper me. That's the problem. So we go into then chapter 18. And in 18, the lens kind of zooms out a little bit. It's not just the story of Micah and his household shrine. Now it's the bigger picture of one of the tribes of Israel. But let's be honest, what chapter 18 really is, it's the eye exam. It's the reality check. Thus far in the story, things have not gone real well for the tribe of Dan. When they came into the land, God, through Joshua, appoints a region for the tribe of Dan that is to the south and west of Ephraim. It's a little bit of the Shephelah, the hill country, and then some of the coastal plain. But the problem for Dan is that area, at least in the time of Judges, was occupied by the Philistines. They were never really able to establish themselves in the region. They never took possession of the land. And in that situation, as a tribe, they have significantly diminished to the point where there's only 600 fighting men left. That's like a town. That's not a tribe. And actually, you see this in the Hebrew. The language oscillates back and forth between the language of tribe and the language of clan, as if it's not really clear if they're really a tribe any longer. You'll remember in earlier portions of Judges, it was nothing to summon 10,000, 20, even 30,000 fighting men from a tribe or a couple tribes, but 600 men. And they don't have a lot of prospects, and they've not had a lot of success. And so they send out spies. They're going to go look for land, any land that they think 600 fighting men can reasonably conquer, because they need a place for themselves. And the only real place to head is north. And so a couple spies head north. As they pass through the hill country of Ephraim, they pass by this shrine, and they hear a voice that they recognize. We don't know where they knew him from before, but they recognize the voice, and they turn aside, and they see this Levite that they know, and they inquire about how it is that he got to be here. And he's like, well, the guy pays me, and so now I'm his priest. And they, well, if we got a priest in the shrine, let's inquire of the Lord. And they ask, are we going to be successful on this endeavor? He says, oh, yeah, you're going to be successful. And they go north, and they do find a city that doesn't really have strong political affiliations with any of the people groups around them. It's in a good, habitable land. And so they return to the 600 men, and they say, listen up, we found the place. God is with us. Get up, we're going to go. And that's what they do. So the whole tribe of Dan, they pack everything up, and they start heading north. As they head through the hill country of Ephraim, they stop by this shrine where they met the priest, where they got the good word about the place that they're going. And when they get there, the priest comes out to greet them at the gate. They start going on in. The priest says, hey, what are you doing? They say, keep your mouth shut. How about you come with us? Would it not be better to be the priest of a whole tribe and not just one man's house? And all of a sudden, the Levite sees an opportunity to upgrade his situation. He says, that sounds pretty good. So they go in and they grab the idol of Yahweh, and they grab the ephod, and they grab the teraphim, and they take off. Now notice in the text it says that they put the women, the children, the people, and possessions out in front. The 600 men stayed in back. Why? Because they knew they were picking a fight. And they head on down the road. Micah doesn't seem to be present in the scene. It seems that he was unaware of what was going on, but he figures it out soon enough. He rallies a couple men. He goes after them. When he sees them on the road, he begins shouting at them, because you can understand he's a little unhappy about all this. So they turn around and say, dude, what's your problem? Why are you shouting at us? What's my problem? Are you kidding? You've taken my gods that I made and the priest. What's left for me? How can you ask me what my problem is? And they respond, you better keep your mouth shut. Because if you don't, some violent men may jump on you and you'll lose your life and your household. You notice how when everybody does what is right in their own eyes, those who are in a position of power always seem to be more right than the rest. That's interesting. But Micah knows he doesn't have the force to fight him. There's nothing he can do, so he turns around and he goes home. But this is that moment for him, when he recognizes that the way he thought things were did not coincide with the reality. He thought, surely Yahweh's going to bless me. I've got all these things in my shrine. I've got the Levite as my priest. He's like a son to me. Some son. He went with Dan willingly. It matters that you get your perspective lined up with reality. So Dan goes on north, and they find this little town, unsuspecting, relatively defenseless. They conquer it, put everybody to the sword, destroy the city, rebuild the city, and name it, you guessed, Dan. And you can understand from their perspective why they might think that everything is absolutely peachy. Because all of a sudden, everything has just worked out, right? They needed a place. Now they have a place in a good land. It wasn't very clear early on whether they were a tribe or a clan, but now they've reasserted themselves. At the end, they used the tribal language again. It's like now they found place and identity, and they have this God that promised good fortune and gave it to them, and they brought that God with them. And it says that they set it up and made the young man priest and his sons after him. Everything is going right. Like, if you're in the tribe of Dan, you're thinking, wow, Yahweh has really blessed us. And they set up the idol, and presumably they worship it by the name of the Lord. And then you find something very, very interesting in the text of verse 30. It says this, "And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan," we finally get the name of the priest, "Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land." Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses. Now that's what the text says. But if you were Jewish, that's not how you would read it. Quick history lesson. So when Hebrew was first written down as a language, it was more like a shorthand. You only wrote down the consonants. It's like a baking recipe. You understand that TBSP is tablespoon, TSP, teaspoon. And you don't get those two mixed up, or else you wreck your recipe. Don't ask me how I know that. This is how Hebrew was written down. It was shorthand. They didn't write the vowels down. You just kind of knew. But as time went on, they discovered that sometimes people would use the wrong vowels, and you'd have two words that had the same consonants but different vowels, and you just had to know by context what the right word was there because you didn't have the full pronunciation. But sometimes people didn't know the context, and so they were apt to misinterpret the text. And so they decided they needed to put the vowels in so you really knew what the word was. This created a problem, because the Hebrew people believed that the written text itself was sacred. You couldn't change the word of God. So it's not like you could just space out the consonants and insert the vowels. That would have changed the sacred scriptures, and that was not okay. So what they came up with is what we call the pointing system. Instead of changing the actual text, they just drew little dots and marks around the consonants, and those dots and marks told you what the pronunciation was. It basically supplied the vowels without changing the text. But what happens here is something very, very strange. Instead of supplying just vowels, they also supply a consonant. They don't actually change the text. The consonant's just kind of up there hovering over the word, written a little small. It's the Hebrew equivalent of the letter N. And it changes the way you would have read the verse. Instead of saying, "Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses," it would have read, "Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Manasseh." Now, Manasseh is a totally different tribe, and we already know he's a Levite. So any Jew reading this story would know immediately that's not the literal truth. We know he wasn't the son of Manasseh. We know Gershom wasn't the son of Manasseh. So then the question is, why would you intentionally mispronounce the word? Here's what I think. I think Micah, I think the whole tribe of Dan, all thought they were doing the right thing. From their perspective, this was the will of God, and God was blessing them. It all felt so right. But from a broader perspective, especially when you know the Torah, all of this seems absurd and ridiculous. Everybody else from the outside looking in recognized that God had not blessed Dan. Dan had given up on the promises of God and settled for something else, a different place that God had not promised to give them. Everything that happens in these two chapters is absolutely ridiculous. And so when they read it, they did not want to drag Moses' name through the mud. Because what does Moses represent? Moses represents covenant. Moses represents Torah. Moses represents the Ten Commandments that they have been flagrantly disregarding throughout the entire story. It's a check on perspective. So what we have in these last five chapters is not stories about judges, which we've come to expect from the book of Judges, but we have five chapters that paint a picture of what life really was like for the people during this period. It's a picture of what it looks like when everybody does what seems right to their eyes and their perspective. Chapter 17 and 18 give you stories about religious chaos. And it's just absurd what they do when you think about the religion God prescribed. It's religious chaos. And then chapters 19, 20, and 21, I'd encourage you to read it on your own time, are stories about moral chaos. The sort of moral chaos that quickly follows on the heels of religious chaos. But really what it is a picture of religion that has grown old. You have to understand, this in fact is the problem with religion. It has a propensity to age faster than we do. All that Israel has left is religious forms devoid of content. It's like an empty pitcher. The form itself suggests that it has water. It contains in the form the promise of refreshing until you come to it and are very disappointed and you're left thirsty. That's what religion in form without any content leaves you with. That's all Israel had. They had his name on their lips, but did not have his ways in their heart. They had the right priest, but the priest did not lead them back to God. They had memory of a covenant relationship, but they did not have the relationship itself. Because it had already grown old. You have to understand, covenant relationships, they have to be renewed. Because if you don't renew them, they get old, they get tired, they get stale, because that's how human relationships work. This is why you see Moses and Joshua and other great leaders in Scripture renewing the covenant. I think this was the idea behind all of the great festivals that Israel was supposed to celebrate year in and year out. Think of the Passover. It was a way of coming back to the promises and the covenant and the relationship of God and celebrating it and renewing it in remembrance and giving new life to it. But if you don't do these things, it grows old and it dies and it can never deliver on what you think it can deliver on. When you hear somebody say, and this is my opinion, the ridiculous phrase, well, I love Jesus, I just don't like religion. That's what they're talking about. Because I don't know anybody who's ever gotten upset because somebody has just a rich, vibrant, fresh relationship with God that just happens to be expressed in this or that concrete fashion that we might call religion. Nobody gets upset about that. What they get upset about is old and hollowed out religion that never seems to deliver on its promises. But all relationships are like this, you know, right? If you have friends from back in the day and you don't keep up with them, what happens? You're not really friends anymore. You've got a lot of great memories, but there's no friendship there. This is how the covenant relationship of marriage works. This is why you should be celebrating your wedding anniversary. There are things that married couples do to renew the love and the vows and the commitment that is the essence of marriage. If you want to be married happy 30, 40, 50 years, you're going to make that relationship new again and again and again and again. And that's what leads to a happy marriage. And there's lots of people that get 30, 40, 50 years down the road, and all that's left is the forms. They live in the same house. They share the same bed. They've got the marriage license framed. It's legal, and it's on the wall, and they still wear the rings, but the love that is the true essence of the marriage has long grown old if you don't remake it. And the same is true for our relationship with God, because that's how covenant relationships work. And that's the risk for us today, is that we sit in these chairs and we sing the songs, and you might even be a regular tither in our church, God bless you, and we have all the forms. But the essence, the life, the relationship, It's not there. Can any of you this morning give testimony to an earlier stage of faith and belief where it was vibrant and it was exciting and you just felt so close to God, but it's not that way anymore? Now that relationship, it changes and it doesn't always feel the same, but is it still there? Or has it dried up? And how would we know? Let me give you a couple things that I think might be signs for us about how fresh, how renewed it's been. First question you can ask yourself is, when was the last time you renewed the relationship you had to God with God? When was the last time you just honestly came before God and said, you know what, God? This relationship we have, this covenant, your salvation, your grace, your love for me, God, that's awesome. I don't even have words to tell you how thankful I am about it. I do just want to say, God, I'm still all in. And I don't do it perfectly. You know that better than I do. But God, I am all in with you, whatever it costs. When was the last time you had that talk? Here's your second sign. Have you gotten comfortable? If you found a faith, a way of doing religion that's really, really comfortable and you like it, that should make you uncomfortable. Because if a covenant relationship is always new, there's always going to be some dimension of it that's not really familiar, and there will always be a little discomfort. You'll never really get to settle. And this is a paradox. Because it happens at the very same moment that my relationship with God is the most comforting thing in my life. Of course I'm comforted by the idea of God's salvation and His grace and His mercy and the infilling of the Spirit and His power at work in my life. Like, that's my whole hope. Of course I'm comforted by it. And yet God continues to draw me on this journey where I haven't arrived yet. I'm not to a place where I'm ready to sit down and get comfortable and say, this is good enough. There's always more. I'm always being called heavenward to be more and more and more like Christ. And I ain't there yet. Don't say amen. You don't want to be too comfortable. Of course He's comforting, but your faith, your religion, it shouldn't be too comfortable. The third sign is when God starts to be something of a token in your life. Something you keep in the shrine for when you need to seek guidance, or when you just need to be comforted, but He's kept in the shrine. And maybe He doesn't go to work with you. He lives over here, but not here in the center of everything else. It's when God is no longer the end, but the means to the end. It's when we want a relationship with God because of what we think we can get out of it. And this is such a subtle thing. We'd never overtly admit we're there because then we're like, oh, well, yeah, I'm in idolatry. It's very, 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 very subtle. And remember, the problem is we're always going to see things like right. Don't let God become a token. Don't let Him be just the ticket to heaven. It's a question I put to you before. I'll put to you again because it's a really important question. Would you settle for heaven and all you think that means if you didn't get God in the end? And if you'd be willing to settle for that, then God's just a means to an end, and He's not the end Himself. Now, of course, the question is logically invalid because the greatest thing about heaven is God. But don't settle for anything less than Him. And the last question, maybe the last sign you look for when you're trying to assess whether or not this relationship and your expression of religion has grown old is, what else do you find in your shrine other than Him? Because the thing is, we're pretty eclectic beings. We've got God, but we tend to add a lot of stuff to God. I've met a lot of Christians who fashioned an ephod for themselves. Remember, an ephod is a way of inquiring of God. We've got a lot of Christians that I don't know if they really understand what a dialogue-based relationship with God would look like. I wonder if they subconsciously avoid it, but they also know they want to get answers from God. We want a yes, we want a no, we want to turn right, we want to turn left sort of answer. And so we devise means in our lives to extract the sort of answers we want from God without ever having to engage in a conversation and risk a real encounter with the divine. Because what we really want is answers to our questions, because we think if God gives us an answer, we're guaranteed success, which is what Dan wanted, which is what Micah wanted, which is what a lot of us want. Because when you come face to face with God and you kind of open yourself up for the dialogue, you run the risk of God saying, your question itself is invalid. You're asking the wrong questions. Oh, I just wanted an answer. And a lot of us, we gather teraphim. Household gods. I mean, just little things. They're so tiny, they don't look very imposing, they don't look very threatening, and they're never as big as he is, because God is the big thing in our life, but we got all these other little things. And as long as they're not bigger than him, we kind of deceive ourselves into thinking they're not that big a deal, and yet they tend to clutter up the shrine of our life. What are those other distractions, the other things that you think, if you have them in your life, are going to secure for you well-being, blessing, stave off chaos? What sort of attention do you give them? What sort of love? Teraphim are the things we gather around our lives to insulate ourselves from the discomfort of a radical, singular commitment to God. Because let's be honest, if you've ever met somebody who is wholeheartedly, whole-mindedly committed to one thing, they probably struck you as a weirdo. Because their lives seem to us to be out of balance. Like, so you only care about that? Like, that's weird. You do know, right? That's the call of discipleship, the call to follow Christ. It's to be a bunch of weirdos in the world. That because we're weirdos that have given every aspect of our life, no other little gods besides, just all of us to Christ, we become channels and conduits of his grace and his power at work in the world. Yeah, there's really good applications from the Old Testament to contemporary living. So here's how I want to close this morning. I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up. And I want to give you an opportunity to have that conversation with God. I want to give you the opportunity this morning to come back to that place and make new that which may have grown old, to say, you know what, I've neglected this thing. I've given attention to other little gods in my life. And I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to take him off the throne of my life. He's still the main thing, but there's this other stuff. Or maybe we've just not engaged in the conversational relationship God wants to have with us. We've been doing a lot of talking, just not a lot of listening. I don't know where you're at this morning, but what we're not going to do is risk too many religious forms, because sometimes those forms do end up being empty. So we're not going to open the altar. We're not going to ask anybody to raise hands. There's not going to be any of that. All we're going to do this morning is give you an opportunity in the quiet of your heart this morning, in the seat you're sitting in, to do business with Almighty God. To stand before him and say, God, I want this to be new again in me. I want it to be fresh. I want it to be vibrant. And I want anything else that takes away from that gone. Because your salvation is awesome, and your love, and your grace, and your mercy, it's incredible. And this morning, I want to be all in.